Last night, two of television's most challenging and intricate series, AMC's Mad Men and Rubicon, presented their season finales. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, has some thoughts about those last episodes and whether he should be talking about this at all.
The last time I gave any details about a show I was reviewing and praising, the season premiere of Showtime's Dexter, I got some emails and postings from listeners who were upset that I was ruining the show for them by revealing plot details. It didn't seem to matter that the plot details I was discussing were from the previous season. But it matters to me. So before I talk at all about last night's Mad Men and Rubicon, let's get something straight. Here's my official position on what are called spoiler alerts. Before a show is broadcast, I'm very careful about how I describe it. I want viewers to enjoy the same surprise as I did. But after it's been seen by millions of people, if you want to wait a few days to watch it on TiVo or a few months or years to see it on DVD, that's your business, not mine. After all, there are always people who still haven't seen that movie where the big surprise twist at the end is that the guy is a ghost, or the girl is a guy, or the secret word is a sled. How long do we protect them and keep our critical mouths shut? With movies, it's fair to keep quiet during its original theatrical run. But on TV, its national premiere is its original run. So if you don't want to know even the most general details about last night's Mad Men and Rubicon, duck away for a few minutes. This season of Mad Men began, quite literally, with the question, who is Don Draper? It ended, after a year of crisis at work and aimless hedonism at home, with the most surprising of twists. Don Draper was happy. So happy that he surprised not only us, but himself, by taking his secretary, Megan, as a babysitter on a Disneyland vacation with his children, then presenting her with an engagement ring. Jessica Paré plays Megan. John Hamm plays Don Draper.
I don't know what it is about you, but I feel like myself when I'm with you. But the way I always wanted to feel. Because I'm in love with you, Megan. And I think I have been for a while.
Don. Oh, my goodness.
Open.
It's beautiful.
When I saw you sleeping there, I thought, I couldn't imagine not seeing you there every morning. Will you marry me?
I don't know what to say. This is all so fast.
Rubicon, on the other hand, surprised us by ending with a non-ending. The hour started perfectly, with Will, played by James Badge Dale, instructing his intelligence team to connect the dots. But to be careful, warning that just because all leads were pointing to the same conclusion, that didn't make it so.
It's almost as if they wanted us to find all this.
Slam dunk.
Exactly. Now, we've already had one failure. I don't want to just spin some theory here. I want to make a case, and I want to make it airtight.
It is airtight. This is intelligence, not law enforcement. CIA and DIA have already made up their minds. FBI is right behind them. We're just stalling.
No. No. Let the CIA and the FBI and whoever else jump to whatever conclusion they want. We are not going to do that. We are API. We are the safety. We have to get this right.
In the end, Will followed his own trail and ended up implicating the boss of his own agency and confronting him on the roof. We knew this confrontation was coming. But all we got at the end was a tease and a non-ending. The writers clearly were more concerned with setting up a season two than concluding a season one. But that's where I cry foul. I can, and often do, defend TV series that start slowly by comparing them to novels and saying they deserve time to build. The fans who stayed with Rubicon all season deserved more. They deserved a conclusion. My final conclusion is that TV on Sunday nights, even without Rubicon and Mad Men, is alive and very, very well. Boardwalk Empire on HBO just presented its best episode yet. Showtime's Dexter just set up an intriguing new plot with Julia Stiles as a victim saved by Dexter and about to turn vigilante herself. BBC America just premiered Luther, an impressively intense new detective series starring Idris Elba, the actor who played Stringer Bell on The Wire. And next week, AMC premieres its newest series, The Walking Dead, which I've seen and I love. But for now, I won't say any more than that. Don't want to spoil anything.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of TVWorthWatching.com and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. His book, Dangerously Funny, The Uncensored Story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, has just been published in paperback. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR.
A little Muppet girl has started a sensation. The unnamed puppet with an afro sings a love song to her hair.
It's curly and it's brown and it's right up there. You know what I love? That's right. My hair. I really love my hair.
That song, I Love My Hair, debuted on the October 4th episode of Sesame Street. The song was posted on the show's YouTube page, and then women began posting the video on their Facebook pages. African-American bloggers wrote that it brought them to tears because of the message that it sends to young black girls. Well, we're joined now by the man behind the Muppet. Joey Mazzarino is the head writer of Sesame Street and a Muppeteer. He's in our studios in New York. Welcome, Joey.
Oh, thank you, Melissa.
And how did this song come about?
The song came about because I have a daughter who's African-American, and my wife and I are both white parents. And about a year ago, my daughter was going through a lot of stuff with her hair, and she wanted to have long blonde hair and straight hair, and she wanted to be able to bounce it around. And I started to get worried, but I thought it was a problem that was sort of unique to us being white parents of an African-American child. And then Chris Rock's movie came out, Good Hair, and I realized, that, oh, wait, this is a bigger issue.
So you wrote the song, and tell me about writing the song itself. Did you?
The lyrics, I just kind of wanted to say what I want to say to my daughter. And what I do say to my daughter is, like, your hair's great. You can put it up, you know, you can put it in ponytails. You can put them in braids. You can do cornrows. You can do so many great things. I wish I had hair like you.
My hair looks good in a cornrow. It does so many things, you know. That's why I let it grow. I love my hair.
Where do you think your daughter at age 5 was getting this notion that she needed sort of long blonde hair?
She was actually younger than that. And it's all around her. And I mean, she's huge into princesses, and thank goodness there's Tiana now to give her a positive African-American princess image.
You're talking about the Disney princess?
Oh, the Disney. I mean, she loves that princess now, and I'm really grateful for that princess. And, you know, even I think dolls and stuff, they can do better on all their product. They might have brown skin, but they don't have curly hair. Hmm. Everything's straight hair, and it's not helpful.
Well, tell me about the response that you've been paying attention to. Have people written to you directly?
You know, I got a call from a state senator's office the other day, and it was wonderful. It was somebody who was some deputy that worked for him. And she was an African-American woman, and she said, I'm an older woman, and this song, I saw it, and I started to cry. I was amazed because I sort of wrote this little thing for my daughter, and here this adult woman who it really touched her, and then I started reading the comments on the YouTube channel, and it's been amazing. I start to well up when I read them because it's people saying, I wish I had this when I was 30 years ago. I'm going to share this with my niece. I'm going to share this with my daughter. So I'm just happy that this is getting out there.
Hey, Joey.
Yes.
Do you love your hair?
What's left of it, I do. But I wake up every morning, I look at the pillow, I say, oh, I used to love you. Why did you leave me?
Well, Joey Mazzarino, great to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Joey Mazzarino is head writer of Sesame Street. He's also a Muppeteer. And before he left us, he gave us a bit of advice on the news in the voice of the Muppet Murray.
I was following the thing about the miners in Chile, and I was happy they were out of there.
Yeah, that's a good news story, right?
That was a good news story. I like good news, Melissa. Don't get me any of that bad news. I only want good news, please.
I'll talk to my bosses about that.
Thank you. Yeah, just say no more bad news on the show.
Got it.
Or flying free, they're their perfect dresses, you see. My hair is part of me, an awesome part of me. I really love my hair. I love my hair.
This weekend, the PBS anthology series Masterpiece Mystery imports the first of three weekly TV episodes featuring the detective identified by the Guinness Book of World Records as the most portrayed movie character. The character, based on the short stories and novels by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, is Sherlock Holmes. The new TV series is simply called Sherlock. Our TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
Before I previewed the three installments of this new Sherlock TV series, I wasn't convinced we needed another adaptation of Sherlock Holmes. Last year's movie version featured a solid star turn by Robert Downey Jr., but was much too overblown, underwritten, and entirely unmemorable. Besides, we already have Hugh Laurie as television's House, who's basically Sherlock Holmes as a doctor with a limp. Except that instead of one Dr. Watson as his companion and assistant, House has a whole team. And before solving his case each week with a flash of brilliant diagnosis, House always gets it wrong a few times, something Sherlock Holmes would never do. But the new British import Sherlock, beginning this Sunday on Masterpiece Mystery on PBS, gets everything right. It's a modern-day version with storytelling approaches to match. Sometimes, when Sherlock is explaining the reasoning behind his astounding powers of observation, the camera zooms in tight on the various clues with whooshy sound effects, just like an episode of CSI. And why not? This guy was the original one-man crime lab. Sherlock Holmes is played by Benedict Cumberbatch, a young actor who has a great-sounding name of his own. John Watson, M.D., is played by Martin Freeman, co-star of the original British version of The Office. And the series is co-created, with obvious passion for the original stories, by Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss, who last worked together on Doctor Who. That may sound like an odd team, but it's actually a great fit. Doctor Who, like Sherlock Holmes, is worlds smarter than everyone around him, and goes about his adventures with a loyal companion in tow. And while Doctor Who is an alien, Sherlock only feels like one. This new Sherlock series definitely gets all that. And the changes it makes in telling new stories and reshaping the characters are as smart as the elements it retains. When Sherlock first meets Dr. Watson, for example, he instantly sizes him up as a war veteran who's in therapy and who's just returned from action in Afghanistan or Iraq. It may sound like an easy update, but in A Study in Scarlet, the original 1887 story in which the two men met, Watson had just returned from Afghanistan. And in this first TV adventure, called A Study in Pink, Watson's demand for Holmes to reveal himself and his tricks is just as clever and delightful, even with all the CSI zooming and swooshing. In this scene, Holmes and Watson are riding to a crime scene when Watson demands some answers from his baffling new acquaintance.
Who are you? What do you do?
What do you think?
I'd say private detective.
But?
But the police don't go to private detectives.
I'm a consulting detective. The only one in the world that invented the job.
What does that mean?
It means when the police are out of their depth, which is always, they consult me.
The police don't consult amateurs.
When I met you for the first time yesterday, I said Afghanistan or Iraq. You looked surprised.
Yes, how did you know?
I didn't know, I saw. The haircut, the way you hold yourself, says military. But your conversation as you entered the room...
A bit different from my day.
Said trained at Bart, so army doctor, obvious. Your face is tanned, but no tan above the wrists. You've been abroad, but not sunbathing. He limps really bad when he walks, but you don't ask for a chair when you stand like you've forgotten about it. So it's at least partly psychosomatic. That says the original circumstances of the injury were traumatic, wounded in action then. Wounded in action, Suntan, Afghanistan, or Iraq.
You said I had a therapist.
Got a psychosomatic limp, of course you've got a therapist.
This new version isn't just good, it's terrific. And the changes bringing the characters into modern-day London are inspired. Sherlock no longer injects himself with a 7% solution of cocaine to get a buzz when he's bored or baffled. Now he slaps nicotine patches on his arm, lots of them. And this new Sherlock Holmes carries a cell phone. But, like the antisocial misfit that he is, he much prefers to text than to talk. The three stories, new spins on old themes, are about murders disguised as suicides, a deadly smuggling ring, and a mad bomber. They're fast-paced and surprising and truly exciting and very well acted. That goes for the supporting cast as well. Rupert Graves plays Inspector Lestrade, and the evil Professor Moriarty is here too. But I can't tell you where or who plays him without spoiling some of the fun, because Moriarty loves disguises and loves to hide in plain sight. Readers of the original stories know that already. But even if you're not familiar with the old Sherlock Holmes adventures, you'll love this new Sherlock series. However, if you are familiar with them, chances are you'll love this new Sherlock even more.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of TVWorthWatching.com, and he teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. His book, Dangerously Funny, The Uncensored Story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, has been published in paperback. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurak directs the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.